From the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. It's Friday, September 20th, 2019. In this week's edition of the CRE News Hour, we'll talk about the correlation between college football prowess and student housing values with CBRE's Jacqueline Fitz. We'll talk about a new emphasis on creative partnerships by co-working companies with Brock Stressberger of co-working company Convene, and we'll look at the latest performance trends in the data center marketplace with Beau Bond of Jones Lang LaSalle. We'll be back with the top CRE news stories right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. We'd just like to make note of a new option on the show page for this episode. You can click on the purple Take the Survey button right below the podcast player and share some information that will help us get to know our audience better. We'd also appreciate your considering financial support for the CRE News Hour by visiting our Patreon link and becoming a show supporter. You can also leave a tip in the tip jar by clicking the blue quid button right in the middle of the podcast episode page. And if you're interested in becoming a sponsor of the CRE News Hour, write to me at steve@statebroadcastnews.com and we'll send you the rate card for advertising and commercials. Now let's take a look at some of the stories that are moving CRE markets across the country. Demand for design services in August took a markedly downward swing compared to July's already soft score. A new report released by the American Institute of Architects says the AIA's Architecture Billings Index score of 47.2 in August showed a significant drop in architecture firm billings compared to the July score of 50.1. Any score below 50 indicates a decrease in billings. The design contract score also declined to 47.9 in August, representing a rare dip for that indicator. Billings in the West stayed modestly positive, while all other regions remained in negative territory. Kermit Baker is the AIA's chief economist.
The sizable drop in both design billings and new project activity, coming on the heels of 6 months of disappointing growth in billings, suggests that the design expansion that began in mid-2012 is beginning to face headwinds. Currently, the weakness is centered at firms specializing in commercial and industrial facilities, as well as those located in the Midwest. However, there are fewer pockets of strength in design activity now, either by building sector or region, than there have been in recent years.
An important zoning change will transform the Fort Washington office park into a vibrant live-work-play location that'll attract new businesses, residents, and investment. That's according to Avison Young. The firm says a new zoning ordinance adopted by the Upper Dublin, Pennsylvania Township in May will spur private investment and development in the Fort Washington office park. That'll have a profound effect on the reimagined area, making it a hub of activity that'll bring jobs and increased commercial property values. The Greater Fort Washington Zoning Ordinance expands the permitted uses in the former Employment Center District. This will allow for multifamily residential and mixed-use real estate to supplement the existing office, commercial, institutional, light industrial, and recreational uses. State senators and representatives from both major parties joined environmental groups in Harrisburg this week to urge Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf to move immediately on new rules to cut methane emissions in the Commonwealth. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, but the federal EPA wants to roll back regulations on emissions from the oil and gas industry. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has proposed new rules to cut emissions from existing oil and gas facilities. John Walliser with the Pennsylvania Environmental Council says this week's event is proof of bipartisan support for the DEP proposal.
The department has been working on this for some time, but until the department puts it out for public comment and issues it as a final regulation, we need to keep moving the process forward.
A recent analysis by the Environmental Defense Fund found that the oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania is emitting 520,000 tons of methane every year. Methane's the main ingredient in natural gas. It accounts for 25% of current global warming. Walliser points out that reducing methane emissions is critical to protect Pennsylvania communities from the worst impacts of climate change.
Pennsylvania is the number two producer of natural gas in the country. And if the federal government's not going to lead on this issue, then it's incumbent on the states to do so.
He adds that cutting methane emissions will also be critical to meeting the commitments in the governor's executive order on climate issued in January. Walliser says opening the comment period on DEP's draft regulations would let the department get input from the industry, the public, and environmental groups to improve the final rule.
There are a few areas we would like to see them strengthen to make sure that they are addressing all the potential sources of methane emissions.
Legislators at Tuesday's gathering emphasized that with the EPA withdrawing from the fight against climate change, it's up to Pennsylvania and other states to take the lead. A new report from CBRE says Pittsburgh's flexible office space inventory grew to 616,000 square feet by the end of the second quarter. That's an increase of 121,000 square feet, or about 24% from a year earlier, and it's grown over 250% since 2014. Flexible space now accounts for 0.8% of Pittsburgh's total office inventory, up from 0.6% a year ago. It's still below the U.S. average of 1.8%. That indicates that there's room for the sector to grow in Pittsburgh. Flexible space is heavily concentrated in Pittsburgh's downtown submarket, which accounts for 34.4% of the market's flexible inventory space. Occupancy in U.S. skilled nursing facilities remained relatively stable at 83.3% in the second quarter. That's a 0.5% decrease from the first quarter, but it's an increase of 0.5% from a year ago. The data comes from the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care, also known as NIC. NIC's second quarter 2019 skilled nursing data report showed occupancy declining in cities, but increasing slightly in rural areas. Skilled nursing facilities are inpatient healthcare facilities for patients who need nursing, rehabilitation, or related services, but don't require hospitalization. A new study commissioned by the National Apartment Association and the National Multifamily Housing Council reveals that the apartment multifamily industry and its residents annually contribute more than $3.4 trillion to the national economy. The new report, available at weareapartments.org, provides a detailed breakout of the economic impact nationally by state and in 50 metro areas. The new data shows how different aspects of the apartment industry positively affect national, state, and local economies. Resident spending contributes $3 trillion to the U.S. economy, while operations adds another $175 billion. New construction contributes $150 billion, and renovation and repairs add $68.8 billion. Among the highlights of the report, all four sectors of the industry have posted very strong growth, punctuated by the construction industry ramping up to meet the unprecedented demand for apartments this cycle, reaching a height of 347,000 completions in 2017, up from 129,900 in 2011. Anchor Health Properties recently closed on three Class A medical office buildings totaling about 110,000 square feet and secured the right to acquire a fourth asset of 40,000 square feet that's currently under construction in suburban markets in Atlanta, Georgia. The Noonan Professional Center 1 and 2 medical office buildings, 2401 and 2301 Noonan Crossing Boulevard, are strategically positioned next to Piedmont Healthcare's Noonan Hospital, one of the fastest growing inpatient hospitals in the health system's network. Anchor Health will also have a right to acquire the adjacent Noonan Professional Center 3 medical office building when it's completed in 2020. The medical office building located at 250 Parkbrook Place in Woodstock is anchored by Northside Pediatrics and North Atlanta Primary Care, and it's in a high-growth community. Novaya Foxfield Industrial, the mid-Atlantic arm of Novaya Real Estate Ventures, purchased 29 acres at 900 River Road in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. Foxfield Industrial will demolish the existing chemical processing plant that's occupied the site for more than 30 years. It then plans to build a Class A 36-foot clear industrial property. It's going to call the King of Prussia Logistics Hub. The property's in an infill redevelopment site in the King of Prussia submarket with exceptional access to Interstates 76, 476, and 276. King of Prussia's primed for Class A industrial product, with the average warehouse being more than 40 years old and only having 20-foot clear heights. You're listening to the CRE News Hour from statebroadcastnews.com. All right, this is a story for sports fans who also happen to work in commercial real estate. It's about student housing, and apparently student housing linked to universities with elite football programs gets the best pricing. It also gets the greatest demand from investors, who are drawn by the large and consistent enrollments, as well as stable cash flows that these properties offer. This is according to the latest analysis by CBRE. College football conferences are strongly correlated with student housing capitalization rates. That's the valuation measure used in commercial real estate to indicate investor interest. The lower the cap rate, the greater the appeal and value. It's the exact opposite of what you want in your football score. CBRE analysis finds that student housing at colleges with elite football programs trade at lower cap rates than properties serving colleges with lesser quality football programs. Joining us to talk about the analysis and about how sports plays into the value of student housing is Jacqueline Fitz. She's CBRE's Director of National Student Housing. Jacqueline, thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. You've done a study for CBRE's student housing that indicates there's a link between the demand for student housing and the value of student housing and how well the school does in football. Tell us a little bit about what you found out.
Sure, happy to. So what we found is that there's a direct correlation between the capitalization rate when you buy the property and the Power Five universities. So we've looked at the cap rates at Division I non-Power 5 universities versus Division I Power 5 universities and non-Division I, and you'll see that there's a distinct differential between the two, where we're seeing cap rates significantly lower at those schools that are at the Power 5 universities. And I think the correlation is more interesting when you think about the type of enrollment growth that universities can potentially see when they win, for instance, the NCAA National Championship for football. And that demonstrates how the power of football can help with enrollment growth, enrollment fundamentals, which then drives a more stable environment for supply demand for student housing investment.
So it's interesting to me that there's even this correlation. What does it tell you about the value of football programs for schools? I mean, there's always a debate, you know, when schools are talking about where they should be spending their money. There's one side that says, oh, we should spend it on academics, and another side that wants to, particularly alumni-backed constituencies, they want to spend the money on games and stadiums and all that stuff. And this seems to suggest that, at least from a housing perspective, that the money's well spent.
So I think that it goes back to a lot towards the visibility of the university when they are playing in these championship games or even, you know, on TV in a positive time slot instead of on some random network, if you will. The visibility is there, and then that drives student enrollment. So what we've seen is applications will pick up first and foremost, and then once the applications pick up, if they maintain the same admitted standards as before, typically that's when you start to see enrollment growth. But additionally, if you know they start to tighten some of their standards as far as who they admit, you start to see students that are of higher quality, and you're improving your student base, which is another good indicator of, you know, a strong university that the alumni definitely want to see. So there is that correlation between, really the correlation is between enrollment growth and or better standard of student and football, which then leads to, if you're an investment professional within the student housing real estate market, to a more stabilized investment that will continue to have rent growth as demand grows for the university and enrollment continues to grow.
Aside from the school-related characteristics that make a student housing property attractive, more attractive, or less attractive, are there other criteria like location or nearby amenities that you factor into the evaluation?
Absolutely. So the biggest keyword that we see in student housing investments is pedestrian assets versus non-pedestrian. So we really look at, are you pedestrian to campus? Can the student, you know, roll out of bed and walk to campus versus are they going to have to take a shuttle bus or drive? So we've seen that spread differential in cap rates be approximately 50 basis points through the first half of 2019. So there is definitely that variable of you can achieve better yield if you're looking to buy an asset that's non-pedestrian. But then the argument is for people that are focused on pedestrian assets is that you can't be built within. And so the demand will continue to be there for those pedestrian assets.
Are there geographies that are more favorable to student housing than others? Is it really more based on what school is there, or can you see a trend among student housing developments in a particular geography?
That's a good question. We've seen typically the largest number of transactions, at least, within the student housing sector occur in the southeastern part of the United States, which are also some of the schools, the SEC conference as being a very strong conference for football. And there's been a pretty large enrollment growth in those universities as well. So that has driven more investment in those markets and then definitely more transactions. Additionally, some of those markets have less barriers of entry than other markets as far as it relates to construction. So I would say that that's the most typical area. The other thing to consider with student housing sector and overall is where the population is still growing. And one thing that we've seen is there are a higher percentage of Hispanic students graduating from high school and going to college than ever before. So we've seen in states where there are a high demographic of Hispanic students, there is more enrollment growth because a larger percentage of them are going to university after graduating from high school. So states included in that include Florida, Texas, California, and those are some of the states where we also see strong enrollment fundamentals.
When you look at the kinds of student housing that's being developed today, it's very different from the student housing of a decade or two ago. Talk a little bit about the differences and what are the most popular features today when people are looking at building student housing.
So when the student housing, I kind of give a little bit of a history lesson. When the student housing sector was initially formed, the majority of the product that was built was stick garden style, you know, located further from campus and but on large plots of land, less dense student housing. I would say as the market has evolved and become more institutional, the student housing sector as a whole, and then also as rents have continued to increase, we've seen more of a flight to developments that are closer to campus, those pedestrian locations, which tend to be projects that are much more dense in nature, some having things like structured parking and not necessarily stick built. So there has been, in some ways, a change from the garden style typical amenities you see to the urban style type of amenities. But I would say overall, they've called it the amenities arms race in student housing. I mean, we definitely have seen projects built with golf simulators. I was at a property last week that had a snowboard and ski simulator that was a property in Colorado. So you definitely see sort of a competition amongst developers on what they can build and what they are building. But I would say the amenity that ultimately becomes the most used amenity, and we've seen developers because of that desire and use really increase the volume of it, are the study rooms. So we've gone from, you know, one computer lab / study room in the older student housing assets to now student housing or study rooms on every single floor of buildings. So we were really focusing on some of the amenities that the students actually end up using. And additionally, those are the amenities that the parents, when they're touring with their students, really like seeing.
And I gather they're spending a lot more time in the common areas, like the study rooms, than they did, you know, decades ago. People tended to live in these cinder block towers, and they would go into their room, and that would be their sanctuary. But now they tend to like to hang out with their friends in common areas.
It's a little bit of both, to be honest. So the one thing that's, you know, different about the student housing sector versus multifamily is that student housing is leased by the bed instead of by the unit. And so there are a lot of instances where someone will come in and with a friend and say, we would like to rent a 4-bedroom apartment, and they're put in 2 beds. And then the other 2 beds are filled with strangers. So in that instance, we see when people are leasing by the bed, but not necessarily with a full unit of people they know, they tend to hang more in their bedrooms when they're in their unit, and then they go to the common areas to be with their other friends because they're not necessarily staying in their living rooms because they're living with strangers. So it's an unusual situation that's becoming more common, and we definitely see that transitioning into the multifamily world with the micro unit concept, with the, you know, the common areas that people are using more frequently. But really, I think that concept is originated in some regards from what we see in student housing, where people are renting a bedroom instead of a unit and signing a lease for a bedroom.
Is the demand for student housing largely driven by the demographic trends in that population, in that age cohort, or is it a bunch of other factors as well?
I think it's actually other factors. So initially, when the student housing sector really grew in volume from a transaction standpoint, we tripled in volume from 2014 to 2016, just in overall volume for the U.S. student housing market. When that happened, people were really chasing the additional yield that could be accomplished in student. So you saw student housing cap rates between 50 to 100 bips higher than what you could achieve in multifamily. So I would say the initial flight to student was based on that yield premium. That yield premium has dissolved somewhat as more and more capital has come into the space. So now a lot of people are looking at student housing as a diversifier within their portfolios, because we do see that student housing definitely is what we call recession resilient. People go back to university when the job market is tough. And because of that, I think that's the reason now most people are investing in this market.
What are the factors you look at in terms of economic statistics to determine, you know, which way the market is going to trend in student housing? Are there particular things you look at?
So we, unlike multifamily, where you're looking really at job data and where the population growth is coming from, a lot of what we look at when we're doing the research on any given university is the university master plan. So many times universities obviously have to plan for their infrastructures years in advance. And so they're putting together these plans that include potential enrollment growth, potential on-campus development. So we're really looking at what that plan for the university is, where the ultimate demand is going to be for the student housing based on the enrollment growth projections. So it's interesting because there's some contradictory evidence that's not necessarily all that you need to look at. It's obviously the easiest and the biggest thing to look at because your demand's coming from your student base. But if you look at a market like Austin and University of Texas has held relatively constant with their enrollment for many years. They don't have any room to grow. They're landlocked around the downtown area and the highway that is there next to the campus. And their student housing has continued to thrive in that market, even though there have been new developments and enrollment has stayed relatively flat. And really, that's been driven by what's happened in the Austin multifamily market, where the Austin multifamily market has gotten very strong. Rent growth has been phenomenal. And it's driven those students that used to live in the multifamily market out of the multifamily market, the by the unit leasing, back into the West Campus market, which is the pedestrian market to UT. So while I still say the biggest factor is enrollment, it's not always the only factor, and you really have to focus on each individual university town, if you will, as its own little economy, because there are so many different factors that can play into it on top of enrollment.
Jacqueline Fitz is CBRE's Director of National Student Housing. Jacqueline, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about the student housing market.
Thank you very much.
With co-working companies aiming to outmaneuver each other, a new emphasis is being placed on creative partnerships and how they can support differentiation of each brand. Convene, which is a partner for commercial landlords in providing premium meeting and workplace solutions, is announcing a new round of milestone partnerships. They're working with Thuzio, the invitation-only sports event company, and Eden Health and Hydra to bring on-site healthcare, wellness, and spa services to co-working locations in New York and elsewhere. Joining us to talk about partnerships among co-working companies and landlords is Brock Strasburger. He's vice president and head of partnerships with Convene. Brock, tell us a little bit about Convene and the premium meeting and workplace solutions you are providing to landlords and commercial buildings. How does that work?
Convene really first and foremost started as a meeting, event, and conference company about 10 years ago. And really, we went to all the Class A landlords and told them that we thought we could help monetize the space a little bit differently. They had amazing buildings, but within the buildings, there was some little pockets of underutilized space. For example, an HVAC floor or a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning floor that has lots of industrial equipment in it. And we thought we could reposition these floors, invest our own money, and build out best in class meeting and event spaces. And so we did that, and that was kind of how we got the scale to start diving into the flexible workplace product as well. So right now, the meeting, event, and conference space accounts for about 80% of our revenue. And we've started to layer on flexible co-working, premium co-working, that is, on top of the more intricate infrastructure that we built for the meeting and event business.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit more how you differentiate yourselves from what people we now can call traditional co-working space. Traditional is probably a little bit early for that, but how do you differentiate from companies that are doing purely co-working space?
Yeah, I think kind of a nod to what I had just mentioned before is that we really have landlords at the core of our partnership viewpoint. So we're looking at kind of activating the entire building as a whole and serving the anchor tenants and the employees and the rest of the building, and not just within our own four walls. So what I mean by that is we have, of course, are working with the community and the members that are coming to work specifically in our spaces, but we're also serving as a amenity and offering for the rest of the folks in the building to come and flex down into if and when they need it. So you can imagine something like the Freedom Tower, where Condé Nast is a large anchor tenant. They have, of course, their own cafeteria, and they have lots of, you know, conference rooms and meeting space. But we have, you know, very specific spaces that are larger. We have, you know, really enterprise level AV and IT, and just spaces that are very conducive to collaboration that they will actually flex down into and use kind of on top of, you know, the space they have within their own four walls when and if they need it.
Now, you're working with co-working companies as well as with the landlords. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So in terms of companies, you mean companies that will work inside of a co-working space, or do you mean, you know, co-working providers?
Well, I mean, co-working providers. Let me clarify, are you providing co-working space or are you working with company? You are doing it yourself.
Yeah, we are doing both. So we have the, you know, meeting and event and conference business on one side of our product offering, and on the other, we have the flexible workplace or premium co-working offering. And so we actually have one or multiple floors of both of those different products within our stack, and we're starting to weave in additional amenities as well. So we might have one to, you know, three, four, five floors of meeting and event space. We might have one to multiple floors of actual co-working that we are operating ourselves, that is with, you know, under the Convene umbrella. And then we're also injecting additional amenity services like fitness and wellness or primary health care, cafes, et cetera, to kind of round out the offering.
So you're the head of partnerships at Convene. Why does the company think that making partnerships with co-working companies, with landlords, that these are important things to do to differentiate themselves?
Yeah, well, we kind of capitalize on our own strengths of design, hospitality, culinary, and technology, and then we really partner on everything else. We recognize that we're really good at certain things and that we're, you know, never going to obsess as much as a primary healthcare company, for example, specifically on primary healthcare. So I think we know what we know, and we know what, you know, others are better experts at, and we want to loop those folks in so that the offering is the best that it can be. And the entire concept of kind of this one-stop shop or, you know, full ecosystem within a building is almost becoming table stakes these days. So for those who are familiar with the New York area, you might know a complex called Brookfield Place. But for those who don't, it's basically this amazing, you know, business complex that has fantastic office space, that has, you know, great F&B offering, amazing retail, an Equinox, childcare, movie theaters, golf simulators, et cetera. And so it has all these bells and whistles. And so you can imagine that if you're another landlord with a building across the street that doesn't have all these bells and whistles, that the retention of your anchor tenants might drop, or you might be forced to lower your lease rates. Or if you have vacancy, it might be more difficult to fill. And so the concept of having, you know, kind of all these bells and whistles under one roof is something that we're, you know, desperately chasing. And desperately is the wrong word, but I guess I meant that we are very thoughtfully chasing, but very serious about it, becoming that kind of amenitization for the entire building. And so we're injecting our core competencies of the, you know, meeting and event and workplace product, and then layering on best-in-class partners in these other categories to kind of round out that offering. And those other categories from a physical amenity standpoint are the, you know, the F&B offering, the primary healthcare, the fitness and the wellness, potentially childcare, potentially pet care, et cetera. And on the softer side of things, you're going to be looking at stuff like concierge services or, you know, kind of a suite of or a library of, you know, perks, offers, and benefits that really you know, benefit the community and make it a really pleasant place to work.
Are we seeing an arms race in the amenity, the kinds of amenities that people are trying to put into co-working or into office space? You know, it started with, gee, we really need to have a nice cafe where people can get free coffee from a coffee maker, where they can get different flavors, all the way up to now. I think you're working with some companies to organize events where people can meet celebrities in sports.
The way that we think about it is something that is sustainable. And that makes sense for the community from an experience standpoint, but also makes sense for our stakeholders from a a revenue perspective as well. To your point about the you know, sports celebrities, we are working with a company called Thuzio, who is doing some very interesting stuff in the future of client entertainment. And so we're, you know, typically thinking about companies that, you know, have like-minded missions and are being, you know, kind of innovative in how they think about the future of a category that resonates with the audience that can be, you know, kind of interacts with within the building. And so what I was saying on the back of that is that in general, you know, from a partnerships perspective and also from a real estate deal perspective, we're typically very thoughtful in how we think about it. And we want there to be, you know, a good purpose and a good connection to the demographic within that building and to the attendees within Convene versus, you know, kind of just doing a deal or doing a partnership just for growth sake or just for the partnership's sake. We really want to make sure that it makes sense kind of through and through.
It sounds like we're reaching an age of a blurring of the lines between work and play. We've heard some people talk about retailtainment, that you need to have some kind of experiential retail thing going on to get people to go to traditional retail properties. Are we finding the same thing in the office space? Do people need to be entertained and stimulated throughout the workday? In this, I mean, it sounds kind of like that's what's approaching.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of goes back to, you know, expanding beyond just the cubicle life that, you know, kind of used to be the bare minimum. Now we're, you know, really thinking about how do we, you know, become that one-stop shop and how do we keep customers engaged. For example, you know, we have Fortune 1000 who may not necessarily have a headquarter presence in one of the metropolitan areas where we do. Or you have a company who is just overflowing and needs to kind of maintain a similar quality in their, you know, for their employees at a location that's nearby. And so the innovation labs of some of these Fortune 1000s are actually starting to take foot inside of Convene locations because they need something cool. They need something interesting and they need something different to keep their employees happy and to also retain talent or to even attract talent in geos that they, you know, currently don't exist in. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it is, it's becoming table stakes. That's like I was saying before, it's just in general, the expectation, not only from the landlords, but from the employers and specifically from the employees is, you know, it's just changing. And so we're trying to, you know, lead the charge with partnering with thoughtful companies that are accretive to that specific experience in the workplace.
Any new services you're going to integrate beyond what, you know, the traditional ones that you talked about? But are there any others that people haven't thought about incorporating into the workspace?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of folks who have thought through kind of what the physical amenity standpoint looks like. We are close on a child care concept. We have looked at pet care. I have not yet seen pet care in the co-working realm, but it's something that, you know, you're hearing a little bit more and more of, especially in areas like New York City. F&B is something that's super interesting. Obviously, there's the standard, you know, kind of ground floor retail world, but there's a concept called ghost kitchens that is starting to gain a lot of traction, and you've heard a couple big names in the tech space who have recently entered as well, and we're looking at, you know, some exploration there.
What are ghost kitchens?
So a ghost kitchen is effectively a commissary kitchen that builds out different bays for companies to come in and rent these different bays so that they don't have to build out a commissary kitchen on their own. And so what I mean by that is you might have 5,000 to 12,000 feet, and you might have 6 to 12 different F&B concepts in there renting smaller kitchen space so that they don't have to go and build a commissary kitchen on their own. And this is on the back of, you know, Grubhub and Seamless Web and Caviar and Uber Eats and, you know, all these other food delivery companies that have started to drive more a larger and larger percentage of these different F&B retail brands, kind of overall revenue stream. And so these folks are starting to acknowledge that maybe they actually don't always need ground floor retail. And instead, they could kind of position themselves around the different regions where they get the most volume for delivery orders and be a little bit smarter and a little bit more efficient. And so the interesting thing for us is it potentially allows us to have a cheaper view at building out one of our own kitchens while simultaneously providing a broader F&B offering to our members, to the rest of the building, and also to the surrounding neighborhood.
Well, it sounds very interesting, and we look forward to seeing some more innovation in the space. And thank you for taking the time, Brock.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Brock Strasburger is the Vice President and Head of Partnerships for Convene. We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. The data center industry saw a slowdown in demand through the first half of 2019. Jones Lang LaSalle is out with a global data center mid-year report. It says that although demand for space remained robust internationally in 2018, so far in 2019, operators have recorded only 256 megawatts across major markets of absorption. That's down 23.8%. from this point last year. Cloud adoption continues to accelerate globally, building off momentum from 2018. The report also notes the majority of development activities occurring in established data center markets as operators around the world expanded established product. Joining us to talk about the data center trends is Bo Bond, Managing Director and Data Center Solutions Co-Lead for Jones Lang LaSalle. He's one of the authors of the report, and we'll put a link to the report in the show notes accompanying this episode of the podcast. Bo, thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. The data center industry has been pumping along, but you're now seeing a slowdown in the first half of 2019. Your report suggests that things are down a bit from where they were last year. Tell us what's going on and what do you think is behind it?
We've seen a slowdown, but I think everything's relative. You know, 2016 was a record-setting year, something we'd never seen before. 2017 and 18, extremely strong, didn't necessarily meet the 16 numbers. But at the end of 18, we finished with, again, just shy of 16 numbers, but again, incredible numbers. The first of 19 has pulled back some. And I think some of that is just ebbs and flows of potential, you know, buying opportunities within maybe the cloud sector or the enterprise sector. I think also the enterprise, the data center developer has deployed heavily. Their infrastructure is out there. They have bought land. They have brought buildings. So there is a healthy supply. So I think we're going to take a little time to absorb that supply. And then, you know, if you kind of look at the public markets, you know, in 2018, we returned probably of the big publicly traded REITs in and around, I think the number was roughly 16%, 18% return, but you get out in front of the first 6 months of 2019, and we've seen numbers in the high 20s. So all relative, nothing to be overly concerned about. I think we just have an abundance of supply in some core markets that with some good leasing activity, we will eat into that inventory. The absorptions will right themselves and will continue to be the darling of that REIT industry.
One of the things you're suggesting in the report is that Most of the data center expansion activity is happening, or development activity, I should say, is happening in expansion in existing product. What's going on? Why are people finding it necessary to expand what are already, in a lot of cases, very large data centers?
Well, I think, first off, you know, there's a lot of investment into those platforms, right? Into those data centers. And so, you know, if you were to think that the network capacity that was brought in is a big number, if you can expand in that footprint, so you're not replicating another network, you're not replicating another deployment, well, there's a lot of cost efficiencies and savings there. So if you can expand in that same footprint by potentially taking down additional power that would allow you to deploy additional servers, right, maybe in a higher U rack, you can gain efficiencies that way. But I think conversely, we are seeing small deployments globally to be able to affect a bigger network, a global network, gateway to the cloud. So I think the expansions are just coming a little differently maybe than they have over the last couple of years.
You talk in the report about recycling being one of the factors that's spurring innovation. What's happening with servers? Why are they being recycled? And what are people spending money on in the new round of investment?
Sure. Well, if you were to talk to a person that spends their days on the data center floor, the equipment on their floor, those servers typically refresh every 3 to 5 years. And since, you know, this data center industry has grown at such a rapid rate, there is such an aggregation of servers, right, that have reached their useful life. And the industry has said, hey, we really need to be good partners. We have greening initiatives. We need to be doing the right thing for not only our environment, but for, you know, also the cost-effective model of running our entire platforms. And so there we have found that we are finding these leftover equipment, the equipment that's reached its end of useful life, they are really pushing it to a recycling company, and those companies are growing dramatically so that they are placed in the right areas, right? We are disposing of that information, that equipment, those cards properly, so that we can check the box that there is no risk. And third, you know, just for our climate, right? We're taking them and we're putting that into to appropriate avenues where we are not being wasteful.
What are the things that people are doing with data that are driving the demand? Is it just more of the same, only more of it? Or is it different kinds of data that people need to access and to upload into the cloud?
Well, that's a great question. I think as you and me as consumers of data, we're consuming data more and more, right? Most of us are cutting the cord, right? How we stream content and video just personally is much greater than it had before. The amount of information that we use on handheld devices, how we bank, how we trade, how we look at insurance, how we read our medical records, all done in a digital format, all that is data transfer. And so we as consumers just use data, whether we know or not, at a much greater rate every year. And then if you think about the big IoT or Internet of Things, as we all call it, right? If you think about machine learning, companies are utilizing that to be able to learn more, to bring us as consumers, to drive business more. So that data aggregation, again, is growing massively. And so where's that going? You kind of mentioned it. A lot of that is going to a cost-effective model where it can go up into the cloud, right? People have virtualized their servers. But I think businesses today are looking at this information and driving decisions because they have the ability to do more with that information and make more concise decisions on how they deploy capital, who they market to, how they protect data. But make no bones about it, the amount of data is growing exponentially.
Is there anything unusual and anything new in terms of data that you're seeing people wanting to store?
you know, I wouldn't say that's one specific item that's driving it. I really wouldn't. You can't just say it's just, you know, government regulation. You can't say it's a specific industry, healthcare or insurance or financial services. I can't say that we personally have just everybody cut the cord and now we're streaming Netflix every day. I think it's a general aggregation of just content information that's driving this consumption of data.
Are there specific areas that developers of data centers look most closely at? And I'm talking geographic areas when they're deciding where to locate a center. I know we've seen some stories about how some of the big Google and Amazon data centers, they tend to put near inexpensive hydroelectric power sources and things like that. Is that still a factor for a lot of these data centers?
Well, definitely anyone that would be building a data center, whether it is a user or whether it is a multi-tenant data center developer or, you know, an operator of sorts that's doing it on a speculative basis for their business, they are obviously building it as cost effective as possible, right? So the people that build it on a spec basis, they're going to the higher concentrations of markets where the users are deploying. And so in the U.S., that clearly is Northern Virginia because of all the connectivity that comes through Northern Virginia and how the cloud providers have all taken down a significant amount of space. Other major markets, you know, where business happens, right? New York, Chicago, Dallas, Fort Worth, Northern California, Southern California, Phoenix, big business centers have been traditionally where these providers have gone. And as they started to see the aggregation, they're developing more. And then you could say on a third category, you know, the people that the data center is their business, where they have the ability to pick it up and put it anywhere in the country or the world, and they don't have to be in a specific geographic area. They have made those decisions to go to places that where they can find extremely inexpensive power, hydro power, right, at 2 cents. You know, those are drivers, but make no bones about it. There are only a few very big companies that can make those decisions to go in, and I'll use a fun term here, a cornfield in Iowa, right? Or could go to, you know, the great Pacific Northwest, you know, on the high desert plain and access some of that real expensive power. A lot of companies can't necessarily deploy a production data center that far away from a business center due to just latency requirements, right? The communication between those two points is too far. And so that's why you continue to see them really in the major metros, which kind of leads into that other big discussion people talk about, which is the edge.
One of the things I've also seen a lot written about is the data mining industry, the people who are doing Bitcoin and other kinds of cryptocurrencies, in some cases taking over existing power generating facilities and turning them into data mining centers. How do those developments factor into your data center analysis, or do they at all? Is that a sector that you're either starting to watch or have been watching?
So we definitely are in tune with that. So the cryptocurrency, you know, is unique because it doesn't necessarily have the characteristics of a traditional data center. It almost mimics more of a manufacturing facility, of a warehouse of sorts. They need a considerable amount of power, and they have the ability to go to, as you described, you know, a generation facility. They don't necessarily have that need to be in a major metropolitan area close to significant connectivity to be able to connect to customers in the world. So that's why you see sometimes they are in some of these remote areas. They also have a lot more fluctuation in the ability to manage humidity, temperature control, et cetera, because that miner, that actual machine, that miner might not have some of the sensitivities that, you know, a very expensive, you know, high compute server might have. So they are, if you were to see some of the mining facilities, they might look very crude or rudimentary in form, but that's because of the aspect of what's happening on that miner And those are actually, you know, those miners themselves are, you know, somewhat disposable. If one was to go down, they just throw another one in there. But you just don't have the control systems in there from a power, mechanical, safety, not necessarily safety, security, that you would see in a traditional data center, where you might see, you know, insurance companies, financials, healthcare, more traditional type industry verticals where they house their data centers.
When you're looking at your economic dashboard, what are the red and green lights that you look at to tell whether the data center industry is in for tougher times economically when you look out over the horizon?
First barometer is always the stock market. And, you know, for over the first six months of the year, the publicly traded data center REITs have done very well. So that gives me a green right there. If you were to look at the global data center footprint, there are countries that are less mature in their data center and their connectivity than the U.S. You know, the first big data center push was here at home. And so we probably are a little bit more mature in some markets. We probably have some markets where the supply might be a little bit greater than demand. And so we will have to have some absorption take place. But I think there are a number of enterprises that are really needing to deploy across the globe because their business is global, and they are reaching out into many different countries to be able to deploy nodes that will give them the ability to get to the cloud in that respective region. So I think the international growth is probably greater than the U.S. growth. And a lot of these very large firms are becoming not only U.S. data center firms, they're becoming global data center firms. So, you know, if we were to say what's the red side of it, I just think there are some markets where we probably have a little more supply than some that would like, but that was because there was a great race to the space. There were people that were trying to deploy to chase customers, and you might have just seen too many people come into a market. But if you go look at the top markets, we're still getting healthy absorption. In the next 4 months, we'll really know kind of how that supply starts to whittle down and really where the numbers are. But I don't think it's something that we have to get overly cautious about. We just need to have exercise really good, prudent business practices from where our investment goes from a provider's perspective, and that you'll probably just see a little less development in the next 6 to 12 months. But I think it will pick back up once that absorption starts to tick up.
Well, thanks very much, Bo. We'll put a link to the data center report in the show notes for this podcast, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Bo Bond is the Managing Director and Data Center Solutions Co-Lead for Jones Lang LaSalle. And that'll do it for this week's edition of the CRE News Hour. Don't forget to check out our audience survey by clicking on the purple Take the Survey button below the podcast player on the show page for this episode. And please consider becoming a financial supporter of our podcast by clicking the Patreon button. If you have comments about our program or a story idea that you'd like to see us cover, send me an email. The address is steve@statebroadcastnews.com. You can also leave us an audio comment by using the voicemail feature on the right sidebar of our website at statebroadcastnews.com. We produce this show in the State Broadcast News studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Some audio in this program was provided by our content partner, publicnewsservice.org. For everyone at the CRE News Hour and State Broadcast News, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.